Good morning. This is Kevin Olenek, Director, Oregon PERS. Before we start the meeting, I want to just go over a few items. This meeting is being recorded and the audio and video will be available on the PERS website shortly. Hosting hybrid meetings means that we have some staff here at the PERS headquarters boardroom and other meeting participants online. If you are online, you'll see a window showing all the board members at their usual seats and a copy of the agenda on the projector behind them. You may also see a window showing an in-person presenter with their camera on when appropriate. We don't have a separate window showing the board packet. It is available as a handout in the GoToWebinar platform or on the PERS website. A few other items to note. As always, public testimony will be taken on action items at the chair's discretion. We did not receive any requests to present testimony on any agenda items at today's meeting. For forthcoming meetings, written testimony can be submitted to the PERS board email address. With that, I will turn the meeting over to Chair Shenoy. Thank you.
Good morning, everyone. Welcome to the April 2023 Oregon PERS board meeting. I'm Sadhana Shenoy, Chair of the board, and I call this meeting to order. First up on our agenda is the approval of February 23 board meeting minutes. Any questions, comments on the minutes as presented? Hearing none, do I hear a motion to approve the minutes?
This is Stephen Buckley. I make a motion that the board approve the February 3, 2023 minutes as presented in the board packet.
John Scanlon, second.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadhana Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
Thank you all. February board meeting minutes are approved. Next is the director's report, and I invite Kevin to present.
Thank you, Chair Shenoy, Vice Chair Fernstall, board members. For the record, Kevin Olenek, director. Welcome to our April 2023 hybrid board meeting. As always, we have a very interesting agenda to work through this morning. A2, the director's report. As I always note, this is a summary of items the board should be aware of and aren't a part of the board agenda materials, which really talks about an overview of recent agency accomplishments. With respect to the forward-looking calendar, just one item to note that the joint OIC-PERS meeting is scheduled for May 31st. OPERF investment report, February returns show regular account earnings of positive 1.02%. With regard to our budget, still holding steady with a projected variance of around 5%. So after that, we will have Rex Kim, Chief Investment Officer for the State Treasury, will present a performance review of the Oregon Public Employees Retirement Fund. For administrative rulemaking, Stephanie will notice one rule and recommend adoption of two rules. Following that, Heather will provide a legislative update with a focus on the current 2023 legislative session. Then Yvette will provide an update on Senate Bill 1049 implementation efforts. Then Matt Graves and Richard Horsford will present the final 2022 earnings crediting and reserving report for adoption. And the last item, C4, our consulting actuaries from Milliman will engage in a preparatory discussion for the board's upcoming experience study. If there's any questions, glad to answer them now.
I just want to say that every cycle, PERS staff has to present PERS the agency and PERS the system to legislative committees, specifically the Joint Committee of Ways and Means and on the and the General Budget Subcommittees. Often committee members are new, and even if they are not, they have to be brought up to speed with all of the details of our agency. This communication of our really complex system is of utmost importance because the presentation has to be simple yet complete and professional. After all, the approval of our budget depends on people understanding all those numbers. It usually falls on Kevin and Richard to make these presentations, and I want to commend both of them for their effort and for the excellent rapport that has been established with the folks in Salem. Special thanks this year to Greg Gabriel and Sheba Paul for their efforts in putting together the presentations. Any other questions on the director's report? Okay. All right. We can move on now. Let's invite Mr. Kim to present the Oregon Public Employee Retirement Fund Performance Review. Welcome.
Chair Chinoy, Vice Chair Fernstell, members of the PERS Board, and Director Olenek. It's very nice to be here with you in person. Marking when I first entered the room, I think the very first time I was in this room was 2016 when I was appointed to the OIC, and then the OIC meetings moved to the new building, I think in 2018. So it's been a while, COVID notwithstanding as well. So April 3rd, first day back from spring break. So I sit in front of you with my goggle tan. excited to share with you the stories of last year. If we could go to the next page, please. So for the agenda, I thought I would provide a little bit of a market environment just to sort of help level set all of us in terms of a shared understanding of where we are in the marketplace today. And obviously there's been a lot of volatility happening, a lot of uncertainty. So I thought I'd share some of the sort of key insights, as at least some of the ideas that I spend my time thinking about. And then 2022 performance, and then a little bit more of a forward-looking sort of perspective in terms of asset allocation as well. I don't have a lot of slides, but at any point, if you have any questions, please stop me. All right, so on this next page is the Consumer Price Index. And this is dating all the way back to the late 40s to the most recent time. And I think we're all experiencing this, so I won't dwell on this too much, but we are experiencing heightened levels of inflation not seen since the 70s and 80s. Most recently, inflation hit above 8%. Most recent readings are hitting above 6%. And obviously, this is something that is not only impacting all of our daily lives, but is obviously impacting the PERS in terms of its liability value and so on. And just to sort of put this CPI number in perspective, the Federal Reserve's target rate of inflation is about 2%. So we're substantially higher than that. All right, if we can move to the next page, please. All right, so over the next several pages, what I wanted to show is how the market is absorbing all this information. And the reason why I like to put it within this context is, and again, this is one of the things that we think about. We have a lot of respect for the marketplace. We think there's a lot of information that could be gleaned. It's buyers and sellers with similar information, disparate information coming together, buying and selling different securities. You get a real good sense for where the market is thinking. So what you see here is what's called the break-even inflation. So you take tips minus nominal bonds, and that's sort of a market expectation where inflation might end up over the next 5 years. And where the market currently thinks, and again, this is as of March 9th, I believe, and back then it was about 2.5%. So slightly higher over the next 5 years than the Fed's target of 2%, but not materially higher than where we have been recently. If we go to the next page. And so this is the year 6 to 10, or the second 5 years of the next 10 years. And again, this is the market's sense of where we are in terms of the market's expectation for inflation. And again, in the second half of the upcoming decade, and that's about 2.2%. Again, getting closer back to the Federal Reserve's 2% target. And if we go to the next page, and I'm going to spend a little bit more time on this page because there's a lot of information to be shared here. So this information is from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange. And it's looking at futures prices for Fed funds and doing some math to try to figure out, well, what is the market's implied probability of the Federal Reserve, the Fed funds rate being in these different tranches? So again, I submitted this on March 9th, and the most likely in terms of probabilities was for Fed funds at the time was between the target rate was 4.5 to 4.75. for the market was suggesting that there was about an equal probability of it being between 5.25 to 5.5 and 5.5 to 5.75. Okay. So on March 22nd, the Federal Reserve raised interest rates, the Fed funds rate by 25 basis points to 4.75 to 5%. That's the target rate. But what's really interesting is that when you looked at this exact same graph, the very next day, the market adjusted abruptly in the completely opposite direction. So if you look at this graph, you would say the market is thinking that there would be another 2 to 3 rate hikes coming before the end of this year. After the Fed funds rate was increased by 25 basis points, the market implied 3 to 4 rate cuts by the end of this year, all the way down to 3.75 to 4%. Now, that's an extremely dramatic move, but at the same time, I would urge you not to read too much into it. There are definitely some market pundits who are saying Fed funds have peaked, we're going to start seeing rate cuts, so on and so forth. There's a lot of complicating factors here. All right. The reality is inflation is still printing hot, but we might have a banking issue. Real economic numbers still seem pretty robust, but there's fears of a recession forthcoming. So there's a lot of competing factors. And so although I think that there is some good information here, primarily because we're sort of many, many quarters into this inflation and rate hiking cycle. But that said, if we were to revert back to the summer of last year, we had this exact same situation where the market was thinking that Fed funds had peaked and by the end of the year, we would see rate cuts. So we've been here before, but I think the information is a little bit more solid now, just if nothing else, we've just been on the cycle for a while. Let me pause there and see if there's any questions.
I know it's risky and perhaps a fool's errand to make ex post explanations as to why things moved. Mm-hmm. But if you had to say between the basis point increase that they did 25% and whatever, and what maybe the Fed chairman said that caused such a great, you know, day before to day after type of change. Do you have any insight into that or any sense about that?
Yeah, I think it has a lot more to do with what he said rather than the 25 basis point. I think the 25 basis point was already in the prices.
Yeah. Yep.
It was really sort of his statements. So,
thank you.
Yeah.
And I wonder how much the banking issue has affected. I think maybe that has a big part to
absolutely.
Play as well.
Yeah, and that's sort of the tension, right? The economic information out there that's still forthcoming is reasonably strong. People's sense for what could happen is still kind of weak, right? People are still expecting there to be a recession at some point. If you look at the sort of another piece of information that I look at, but that's not in this deck, is the yield curve. So if you look at the 10 years versus 2 years, that's been inverted for quite a while. That's historically a pretty good sign, leading indicator of a forthcoming recession. It's got a very strong historical batting average on it, but it hasn't happened yet. Usually happens about 6 to 9 months after it inverts, but we're way past a year, and it still hasn't happened yet. And part of the reality is that if you think all the way back to the great financial crisis, there was a lot of intervention that happened. And some of the market dynamics were being controlled by monetary policy. And so what we're seeing is a bit of an unwinding of that. And as to what the actual impact will be to the real economy, it's kind of hard to predict, but at some point it should have an impact because if nothing else, the cost of borrowing money has gone up quite substantially. All right, and if we go to the next page, please. And this is just the 10-year interest rate for treasuries. And it's currently at about 3.5% after hitting about 4% earlier this year. What's interesting, though, is, yes, 10-year treasuries are up. Yes, cost of capital has gone up. That said, though, with the recent yield curve inversion, longer end of the curve sort of stabilizing and if anything softening a little bit, as the Federal Reserve is raising Fed funds rates, what's actually happening is the cost of real capital for businesses, for borrowers in general, is actually coming down. So yes, it is higher, and that is going to choke off some investment. But that said, that's sort of the tension that's happening. Rate raising is actually making cost of capital on the long end a little bit cheaper. All right, and if we go to the next page, and I'll just from there start talking about performance. So on a relative basis, last year was a good year. We only lost 1.55. Obviously, that does not meet the 6.9% assumed rate. But on a relative basis, in a very volatile year, we did quite well. Relative to other public plans of greater than $10 billion in assets, which is what we consider our peer group, we were in the third percentile. Over 5 years, we're in the 13th percentile. And then this is the one that I think we should all, as Oregonians, be really proud of. Over 20 years, we're in the first percentile. In terms of asset class performance, private equity, real estate, our private markets portfolio in general did really, really well. What's not pointed out here is our real assets portfolio. I know we've been getting a lot of press about our natural resource investments and so on, but those investments last year were up about 25%. So it in a heightened inflationary period, that is exactly the time period when we want those natural resource investments to do well, and they did exactly that. And then one additional point I wanted to make is, and all of you are aware of this, private equity, real estate, all of our private markets investments are one quarter lagged in terms of valuations. One of the things that we've been saying to the OIC is we do expect our performance, our relative outperformance, to subside a little bit because we do expect our privates to get marked down, especially if, for example, real estate. We're not exactly sure about private equity, but at least for real estate, some of the pricing there is probably somewhat stale. So we do expect our performance on a relative basis. If the public markets to start going up, we would expect our performance to lag. If the public markets continue to go down, we'll probably do relatively better.
I have one question about real estate. Within real estate, what's your relative exposure to commercial?
So the way that we break it down is we have office, industrial, those types of more sort of commercial, and then we have more sort of residential as well. Most of our exposure is in the industrial complex. We've been reducing our exposure to office for the past several years. It's still high. We would prefer that it was lower. And obviously with all the uncertainties of COVID and hybrid work and so on and so forth, there's a lot of sort of what I call volatility around it, a lot of uncertainty. So we do wish that we had a little less office, but, you know, it is something that we've been trying to get down for the past several years, even before COVID started.
Thank you.
Yeah. The next page, please. So this is a simple growth of $100 chart. In blue is the actual performance of OPERF. Orange is the 70-30 portfolio, what I like to refer to as the reference portfolio. Mm-hmm. So the way to think about the 70-30 portfolio, and this is something that the OIC has more formally adopted as a concept. So instead of just looking at the OPERF policy benchmark, they're also looking at the passive alternative. So instead of having all the complexity of investing the way we do it, including the illiquid private markets, hedge funds and all these other types of more complex investments, less liquid investments, the OIC could also just pick to be a passive market investor, right? Have a certain amount in public stocks, have a certain amount in bonds, have a much simpler, more liquid portfolio. And so that's what we're referring to as the reference portfolio. And since 1997, the risk-adjusted equivalent between OPERF and the actual experience of a reference portfolio has been best sort of shown by a 70-30 portfolio. So 70% in stocks, 30% in bonds. And you'll see the relative outperformance, very strong outperformance of OPERF over that same time period versus a passive market portfolio. just, and I think this is just coincidence, but I thought it was interesting nonetheless. Our performance has been almost in line with the S&P 500. Again, I think that's coincidence. The reality is that the S&P 500 should outperform OrPerf because it is a more risky portfolio. But I just thought it was kind of interesting to note. And if we could move to the next page. So there's a lot of different ways of looking at risk. And I apologize, this is kind of a eye strain because there's a lot of different colors and so on. But it's the same sort of colors. Blue is OPERF, orange is the 70-30, and the gray bars are the S&P 500. And this is the market drawdown. So it's very simply saying from a high water mark, how much of a loss did you have before recouping that loss back? Or that's defined as drawdown. What you'll see clearly, as I just said, the S&P 500 is, it, at least out of these three choices, the most risky. And so during the great financial crisis, the S&P 500 was down slightly more than 50%, whereas a 70-30 portfolio and OPERF were down about 35 to 40%. So if you put this graph in context relative to the prior page, the way to think about it is that we're able to achieve a similar rate of return to the S&P 500, more return than the 70-30 portfolio, but less risk than the S&P 500 and at the same level of risk as the 70-30 portfolio. And if we go to the next page, I just wanted to drill down a little bit further within the last few years, 2018 to the end of last year, just to show that our relative minimizing of drawdowns over the last several years is part of the reason why we've been able to provide strong returns. One of the keys of compounding capital is not losing money in the first place, right?
Write that down. Could I ask, that is incredibly helpful,
yeah,
to see that. Do you think that any of this is because the private equities might not be quite as volatilely marked?
Yeah, absolutely. Some portion of it is definitely that. There's absolutely no doubt about that. Over an extended period of time, for example, when, you know, the tech bubble of the 2000s, yeah, mm-hmm, the great financial crisis, if those types of drawdowns extend for a sufficient amount of time, privates should catch up in some way. We're not necessarily seeing that. Part of the reason why we think we're not seeing that, especially over COVID and last year, is because if you think about the run-up of the public markets for the 10-year prior, private equity did not follow. It lagged in performance, and so we were getting a lot of questions as to, well, private equity has run its course, it's not providing the level of returns it used to, why are you still investing in it? Well, we think there's still a lot of really good return potential there. You know, again, it's I'm not going to sit in front of you and say that I don't expect markdowns. I do. But given the fact that they weren't marked up as aggressively in the decade before, I think the markdown potential is more muted.
Thank you.
What's the other part that's really interesting here is, especially if you look at the last couple of years, and you see the performance of the S&P 500 relative to a 70-30 portfolio, and from a drawdown perspective, they're pretty similar. And that's largely because of rates rising as abruptly as it did and bonds performing as poorly as it did. And if we go to the next page, and this is one of the ways that I like to show our value add. So again, very similar colors, OPERF in blue, 70-30 portfolio in orange. The difference of the two is the black line shown on the right-hand axis. Generally speaking, and again, each bar is a five-year annualized return over the prior 5 years. So generally speaking, the blue bar, OPERF, is above the orange bars, the 70-30 portfolio. Generally speaking, our portfolio is adding value consistently over this passive portfolio. Over this time period, 87% of those bars are above zero. right? So we're substantially better than a coin flip to bet to do better than a passive market portfolio. And just as a quick side note, if you look at the same math over 10-year rolling annualized periods, it's 100%. So there is something to what we're doing in terms of the investments that we're making that is adding value above and beyond a passive portfolio. And if we can move to the next page, and I wanted to sort of end with the new asset allocation. And this is an evolution that started back in 2008. The emphasis on public is coming down. The emphasis on privates has gone up. The emphasis on total equity or stock market exposure is coming down in preference in exchange for real estate, real assets, and diversifying strategies. Very small change from 2021 to 2022. We're reducing equity exposure by 2.5%, increasing fixed income by 5%, and then we are getting rid of risk parity. And if we move to the next page.
Mr. Kim, before you move on, this is Steve Buckley. Is your 2022 column your actual allocation or your goal allocation? Because I know it takes time to get out of some of these illiquid investments where I think in the past you've been above your target guidelines.
Yeah. So this is the OIC strategic target. So this is the path that they would like for us to move towards. But the thing to keep in mind is that the OIC also sets ranges that we are allowed to operate within. So we don't have to be at the targets. We just need to be able to explain why we are deviating and what our plan is for trying to get back to target. But in terms of actual allocation, as of last Friday, we're about 18% public equity, 27% private equity. The opportunity portfolio does not have a strategic target, but it was about 3.5%. Fixed income was about a little under 24%. Real estate is about 15%. Real assets are about 8.5%, and diversifying strategies is about 5%. So generally speaking, all within range. Public equity is slightly out of range, and that's one of the points of conversation we need to have with the OIC. The reality is that, as you mentioned, rightly so, private equity is going to take some time for us to sort of reduce exposure to, and we're offsetting the exposure in private equity from public equity.
When our advisors give us their best estimate of what the assumed rate of return should be for the next 10 or 20 years, mm-hmm. should they be looking at what the actual allocation is on the date the study's performed, or should they be looking at what the investment guidelines are for the DOIC has crafted?
I would recommend that it's really up to them. They really should be based on the strategic, because that's what we're working towards. Yeah.
Thank you.
If we can move to the next page.
So then we have to note the difference between the public equity, the strategic goal versus what we have right now.
So the increase in bonds is in recognition of the reality that we're in a higher interest rate environment. Right? We can get a higher rate of return. Even in 2021, 10-year rates were yielding 1.5%. It wasn't very exciting, and it using that as a source of trying to achieve the 6.9% was just going to make it a lot more difficult. So we had a lower level of allocation to it. But with 10-year treasuries and bonds in general yielding a higher rate, we can take some risk off the table, increase our allocation to bonds, and still be able to achieve the assumed rate. The other thing it does is, and again, one of the things that I stated is we have less liquid investments, more illiquid investments. One of the ways that we can manage that illiquidity is by bringing down the riskiness of our public market portfolio. So if you were to look at the prior page, the relative riskiness of our stocks and bonds portfolio has come down to almost 50-50. it used to run about 60-40. Now we're getting closer to 50-50. And that allows us to be able to manage our illiquidity. All that said, at least based on Makita, the OIC's primary general consultant, as of the end of last year during the asset liability study, the expected return for the new strategic asset allocation came in around 7.5% with a modestly lower level of risk. And the new reference portfolio, which historically was about 70-30, has come down to about 67.5 in stocks and 32.5 in bonds. So again, modestly lower risk for a slightly higher expected return. And so with that, I would open up to questions if there are any.
Well, first of all, Mr. Kim, thank you for that. Very cogent and fairly optimistic, all things considered, point of view. I just wanted to make, it was really more a comment than a question having to do with the expected rate of return. So as you know, every 2 years, one of the main jobs of this board is to set that expected rate of return. We do that in advance, quite a number of months. And then we do it for a long period, 10 to 20 years, as Buckley just noted. Is my understanding, as I've watched this over the last 8 years now, is that the estimates are often fairly dependent upon the starting point of whether interest rates are high or low and whether price earnings ratios are high, low or high. And that there's particularly a lot of volatility now. And so one of the things I think we've tried to do as a board is sort of try to smooth that out, knowing that we could be in a different place when the rates actually go into effect. Yep. And that, maybe one thing that would be helpful for the board in that is to see that, okay, here's the expectation from today's starting point. But if we were in a somewhat different starting point, looking at the volatility of the last, here's where it would be, and that would give a sense of kind of what the range might be. So more of a comment, but than a question.
I could definitely try to answer that to some extent, if you'd like. So when the OIC embarked on the asset liability study, we worked with Makita and the general consultants, mm-hmm. also with the help of Milliman and staff. And some of the assumptions, underlying assumptions, baked in exactly what you're saying. Mm-hmm. So instead of using T-bills yep. at where they were, we used a long-term expected 2.5%. Okay. Instead of using the net asset value of where it was at the time, we haircut it about 10%, okay. making the statement that we do expect that our private portfolio will come down mm-hmm. a little bit. And in terms of the capital markets assumptions, if I am remembering correctly, I believe Makita and Aon's T-bills expectation was also starting at 2.5%. So it wasn't starting at a high level.
Okay. Thank you. Very helpful.
Comments? So as we've seen over the last two decades, OPERF has been rated the number one performing fund amongst its peers. This is stellar, extraordinary performance. I don't think we could have asked for anything more. We couldn't have even hoped for anything more. Forget about asking for anything more. We are really fortunate to have the State Treasury and OIC manage our funds. And on behalf of the board, I would like to extend my congratulations.
Thank you. Very nice.
Also, best wishes for the future because we depend on you.
We'd like to ask for higher returns.
All of this was strictly on the, compliment level, right? I mean,
of course.
So, thank you again very much Thanks. For coming here, and we will see you on May 31st at the joint meeting.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up on our agenda, we have the Oregon Savings Growth Plan Annual Report. Sam Perez.
Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, Sam Perez, Chief Operations Officer, PERS. Today I'll be presenting item A4, Oregon Savings Growth Plan Annual Report, for Debbie Childers, who is unavailable to report today. The OSGP is our 457 Deferred Compensation Plan. So quickly covering governance and our partners, we have our advisory committee, Treasury, Callan, and the Department of Justice. I would like to publicly acknowledge these partners and especially the members of the advisory committee and their active participation, providing insight, questions, and recommendations. Next slide, please. Our OSGP staff listed here, as you see, we do have a vacancy that we're currently recruiting for. Having a vacancy on this small team does create some challenges with some of our processes and also assisting our Salem office for the visitors that come in. However, the available staff there have really rose to the challenge to meet these business needs, and I appreciate their efforts. In addition, Voya, who's a strong partner of ours in completing our processes and assisting with problem-solving efforts when they come up, they've been a key resource for us. Next slide, please. So a few slides providing our plan summary and also our investment options with performance for the 2022 calendar year. Total plan assets at $2.9 billion. One-third of the assets are in one of the life plan options. Next slide. So performance. Certainly the market has impacted our investments. I know certainly we're looking forward to a market rebound, hopefully in the near future, but we'll see. Next slide, please. So this just highlights the returns for our life plan options of the 10 options that our participants have. Next slide. Here are our administrative fees and our investment option fees. Our admin fees and our investment fees are very competitive. We review our admin fees annually, and currently we're in the process of evaluating those admin fees. Next slide, please. Thank you. So highlighting rollovers, the rollovers to PERS are for trustee-to-trustee transfers for service time purchases at retirement. Just wanted to kind of provide an explanation of those. And our rollover ins, down at the bottom of the slide, we get 60% of our rollovers in from IAP, which gives retirees more distribution options than what the IAP provides. Next slide. So highlighting participants, in total we have over 44,000 participants, which is up 7,000 participants from last calendar year. That was at about 37,000. So this shows our efforts in promoting the participation, and it's working. So we're thrilled with those results for sure. Next slide, please. Then highlighting some breakdown by demographics, reasonable to see higher average savings and account balances for our older participants. Then the next slide. Average monthly contribution by age, certainly we see a similar result, but great to see the early career participants beginning that savings for retirement. So nice to see that. Next slide. This represents our breakdown comparing our state and local governments. Clearly, the state makes up a large share of our participants and assets. We do have an active local government outreach to bring those employers into the plan, and I'll highlight that result in a couple of slides. For communications, we had an active year. We had a campaign that aligned with America Saves Week, a campaign about percent of pay, which aligned with the state's new payroll system that allows percentage of salary contributions now, which we're excited to have for our participants. Additionally, we have the 2022 Expo. As the board is aware, again, it was a success last year for both PERS and OSGP. We're using campaigns to improve our financial wellness education and resources, like targeting for caretakers as well. Next slide, please. Education and outreach. We continue to evolve due to COVID. We continue to provide more virtual and online options and materials. We have a high satisfaction on the workshops of 93%. We're also seeing high action taken. Action from a participant is starting or restarting or increasing contributions, which is great to see those results. Then our local government outreach, we added 20 new employers in the calendar year compared to 9 in the previous year. It is also important to highlight we didn't lose any employers over this past calendar year, which does occur sometimes, but we've been fortunate there. So looking ahead as I wrap up this report out, our goals are pretty simple. We want to increase participation and contributions, educate through the participant's career, and improve our communication and resources for our participants. And then with that, that's all I had, but I'd be welcome to for any questions from the board.
A quick question. Because of the market performance of last year, do you anticipate losing participants this year? Or
we've been monitoring that some. Thank you, Chair Chenoy, for that question. But we haven't really seen a lot falling out. At times, what we see is participants, they'll stop their contributions. But from the chart, we're not seeing a complete slide in that direction. So it's good to see that our participants recognize this is a long-term strategy to keep the contributions flowing. Thank you.
Yeah, this is John Scanlon. I was interested in the roll-in, where somebody might take their IAP and roll it in. Would that only be available to that employee at termination, or could they at a later point do that as well? And then also, I think I remember hearing at an earlier meeting something about Roth IRAs, but I didn't see that up there. Are there Roth IRA options?
Thank you, Board Member Scallion. So a couple of questions there. So for the rollover ends, members can roll in when they retire. That's when we see the bulk of them. I believe that they would be able to, if they withdrew, they could transfer the money over or roll over the money into OSGP. We do have a Roth option within our options for OSGP. So a participant can select a Roth option.
Great. Thank you. And just as a quick follow-up, I have contributed for years to OSGP, so I sometimes call those folks up, and they're excellent. I've always gotten really, really great customer service from them, and they're just helpful and knowledgeable and everything you want in customer service. So they are to be commended. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Next up, we have Section B of our agenda. That's administrative rulemaking. Stephanie Wan.
Good morning, Chair Chenoy, members of the board. I want to make sure everyone can hear me.
Yes.
Thank you. Good morning. For the record, Stephanie Vaughn with PERS. We have three quick items for our administrative rulemaking section this morning, beginning with item B1, which is notice of our earnings crediting rule regarding OPSERP pension distributions. The rule currently makes reference to OPSERP pension withdrawals, which after Senate Bill 1049 was implemented, is no longer an option. So this is just a little cleanup of the rule and removing that language regarding any earnings crediting for distributions from the or withdrawals from the OPSERP pension. This is notice only, so there's no action required, and we do anticipate it bringing it forward for adoption at the June board meeting. Item B2 is adoption of our annual limits rules. These edits incorporate the Social Security Administration limits as well as the IRS limits and the limits within our statutes that are based on CPI, such as the annual salary limitation and the threshold for the member redirect. We received no public comments on the rules, and we made no changes to the rules since notice, so we're seeking a motion to adopt the rules as presented.
This is Lawrence Frenstall. I move adoption of the yearly salary contribution limit changes as presented.
Board Member Jaramillo, second.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Frenstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
So moved.
Thank you. And finally, item B3 is adoption of our required minimum distribution rules. Again, these are very simple updates because the federal government passed Secure Act 2.0, which increased or changed the required minimum distribution age from 72 to 73, effective January 1st, 2023. So the amendments to these rules incorporate that change. We received no public comment on these rules, and we've made no changes to the rules since notice, so we are seeking a motion to adopt the rules as presented.
This is Lawrence Frenstall. I move adoption of the required minimum distribution rules as presented.
Stephen Buckley, I second the motion.
Thank you. All in favor, please say aye. Sadna Shenoy, aye.
Lawrence Frenstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
So moved.
Excellent. Thank you very much.
Thanks, Stephanie. Next agenda item is legislative update by Heather Case. Welcome.
Thank you. Good morning, Chair Shenoy, members of the board. For the record, my name is Heather Case, Senior Policy Advisor with PERS. As is common with my legislative updates, I definitely do have some updates from what I wrote in the memo, which was a short time ago, but a very long time in legislative session time. So as I stated in my memo, tomorrow is the deadline for the legislators in the first chamber, so wherever the bills start, which in our agency's bills case is the House. It's the deadline for the first chamber to hold their work sessions for bills. As I've said before, you'll never hear me on the record say a bill is dead until the gavel falls at the end of session, because all kinds of magic can happen. But the general idea is that after the deadline passes tomorrow, if a work session has not happened for a bill in the first chamber, it cannot move on to be heard on the floor and then the second chamber. There are committees that aren't held to those rules, so the Rules Committee in both the Senate and the House can hear bills whenever they want, and the Revenue Committees, and then as well joint committees, just because they are not made up of members from any one chamber. So they have both chambers in there, so therefore their schedule is also a little more fluid. Our agency bills, I do have a list just of the bills that we are monitoring that directly affect PERS the plan or PERS, sometimes PERS the agency, although those I usually don't let you guys in on because that's even more than the 30 or so bills that are here. But I'd love to focus a little bit on our agency bills, of course. That's what we're most focused on in our legislative tracking. So House Bill 2283 is our PERS modernization fixes bill, as you know. Really, for us, this is a pretty high priority bill. All of them are. But to get these statutory fixes in place before we embark on modernization is very important. So that bill is being heard in work session tomorrow in the House Committee on General Government, Emergency Management, and Veterans. That bill did have a wide enough to relating to clause that it has garnered some amendments. So those amendments will also be heard tomorrow. Those amendments include, and to be clear, the amendments are not from the agency. So we did not suggest these amendments. These amendments came from other lobbyists and stakeholders and legislators. But those amendments will be to include Workshare Oregon payments in subject salary for PERS. So folks who took advantage of the Workshare Oregon program that's run by the Employment Department. Those payments would be included in subject salary. The upcoming Paid Leave Oregon program, which will contributions have already started for that, but the leave will be able to be taken in September. This amendment would ensure that payments to folks from the Paid Leave Oregon program would be counted as subject salary for PERS, and that time off that people take under the Paid Leave Oregon program would be counted as service time for PERS, like other paid leave that is that comes directly from an employer. Previously, we have released a couple of communications from our interpretation of the statute that it would depend on where those Paid Leave Oregon payments were coming from, because some employers are choosing to run their own comparable programs, some are taking advantage of the state program. The third amendment to this bill, which was already, I think, 40, 45 pages, so we're getting pretty long in the tooth for this bill. The third amendment is ensuring that, so for officer, police, and fire members, they have to complete 60 months of continuous police and fire service before they retire in order to take advantage of the earlier PNF retirement age. This bill would ensure that that their service time is what is counted as the 60 months, so that time that they may take off as unpaid leave or times when they do not get service credit will not require them to reset that 60-month clock. So so they can continue to build up that 60 months. So that bill with those amendments will be heard tomorrow. If it passes through, it has a minimal fiscal impact right now. As far as agency implementation, we believe that as long as we're accepting what employers report, and we've been told employers have that information to report to us, that these amendments would not put an additional it would put a small additional administrative impact on the agency, something that we can absorb. So that bill, because it doesn't have a fiscal impact, will not go to Ways and Means. So if it passes through tomorrow from the committee, it'll go to the House floor. That's the most complicated bill. The next bill, 2284, is our divorce fee increase bill. That bill was already passed through the committee, same committee, General Government, Emergency Management, and Veterans. Because it is a fee increase, it does have to be considered and rolled into our budget. It could slightly increase revenue for the agency. So it has to move to Ways and Means, and it's already done so, and it's going to be considered along with our budget bill. And then House Bill 2285 is our Social Security fixes, just deleting some obsolete references in our Social Security statutes. That bill also passed through committee last week and is scheduled to go to the House floor today to be voted on. They have a lot of bills to get through, but it'll be voted on the floor probably sometime this week. Just to talk a little bit about the budget bill. So last time we met, you heard that we would be meeting, our agency would be meeting with the joint Ways and Means Committee Subcommittee on General Government. We did so. We had a three-day presentation, which also included our required reporting. We've been asked to come back this week, April 6th, to update the committee, same committee, on the details of our policy option packages in the budget, progress on Senate Bill 1049, as well as disaster recovery, backup data center, and business continuity updates. So we are preparing presentations for that, and we'll be going down on the 6th to present again. Other than that, I do want to include, I was requested last time to just talk briefly about 2601, since that is a bill that's coming up. It's a, as a reminder, it is about divesting in investments dealing with climate change and companies that support fossil fuels. That bill did have two hearings on February 16th, March 2nd. It has not been scheduled for a work session. So, again, I will never say a bill is dead, but that bill is not being heard for work session as of today. Are there any questions? I also can go, I don't technically like to go into a bunch of other PERS bills before they're passed. I don't have a crystal ball in terms of what's going to pass or not, but I'm happy to take any questions or comments from the board.
Yeah, John Scanlon here. I'm interested in the divorce bill fee adjustment, I guess. Last time you spoke to that, and you said the average, you know, was quite a bit more than what people were paying in terms of assessing the cost. So I've been thinking about that since, and it's like, how exactly do they go about assessing, you know, like costing that out would be the first part of my question. And the second part is, are there any other circumstances of, you know, more complexity or whatever that also are, you know, would create a user fee other than the situation of divorce?
Thank you, Board Member Scanlon. I will speak to the second question first because it's the less complex of the two. That one, there are no other statutorily, I might be speaking out of turn. From what I know of, there are no other statutory situations besides divorce where we are required to pass on administrative costs. We are statutorily required to pass on the administrative cost of creating an alternate payee account, which is 99.9% of the time a divorce. As for the first question, for some reason I just stopped talking like I answered all your questions. As far as the first question goes in terms of assessing the fees, so we did have our divorce team, our specialty qualifications unit, assess the time spent on average with our cases. It's a little bit tough right now because we do not have a system of tracking exact hours. So when we set the fee increase at that $1,300, we set that as a very, very low average of what the unit is doing. We did, in preparation for this bill, have that unit painstakingly list out exact steps of what they're doing for each case and about how many hours that is and what classification of staff does each step. Therefore, that's where we were able to come up with that average. And the average is, it's higher than 1300. We took it down, I think, just a couple of $100, on the cap. Because right now we do not have the ability to track very precisely. We do believe that once modernization is in place, that tracking software will become kind of available or integrated for that unit to be able to do that. Right now, the resources required to kind of track hours. Not only do we not have the technological mechanism right now, but the resources required to track the hours would overload the unit at this point, because basically it would be manually having to track those hours. So we set the cap average low, and then anticipate moving more towards that exact tracking model later. What we plan on doing now, after, if this bill passes, is that we would have that unit assess based kind of on that average that they've reported to us. And if it's lower than that, they charge a lesser amount, but it's going to be, at the beginning, it's going to be pretty inexact until we can get that exact tracking software.
Great. Thank you.
Mm-hmm. Just to follow up, when we calculated that 1300 and did the process you described, that's just the direct cost. Did we add an overhead component or anything like that? But just direct.
There's no overhead. Correct, board member Fernstall. Yeah, that is just the direct, those hands touching that case average.
Any other questions? Thank you, Heather.
Thank you.
Next up is the Senate Bill 1049 implementation update. Yvette, it's nice to see you here as opposed to there.
Why, thank you. Good morning, Chair Shenoy, Vice Chair Fernstall, and members of the board. For the record, my name is Yvette Elledge-Rhodes. I'm the Deputy Director at PERS. Since my last report to you in December, you can see that the program continues to be in red status, mainly due to our member redirect rebaselining delays and a new issue that we ran into with our March 23rd deployment for work packages 9.1 and 9.2. For these two work packages, we require checks to be sent to our Department of Administrative Services Publishing and Distribution agency, then prints the checks for those withdrawal checks. PERS ran into an issue with the formatting, and we have since been working with DASP and DDU to have an acceptable format and agreed upon, and have been successfully testing that. So that's a great step. But these delays caused an impact to the March 23rd release, as well as technical debt work package 6. Fortunately, our Senate Bill 1049 Steering Committee approved a change request that would move that deployment to June 29th so that we can incorporate those check file changes. The downstream impact to these delays is expected to also move our January 2024 deployment by a few weeks, but it's not to impact any budget or scope, so that's also fortunate. We continue to make progress on all the other work packages. Schedule updates continue to be in process to incorporate 3 change requests that we have, the change requests from the last time we met, which had to do with our work packages 8 and 11. So all of those are being now taken into consideration for that rebaselining. So it, just to sum it up, I feel like, you know, this is an issue. When we have to work with external stakeholders, there have been some challenges on our end to make sure we're in front of them early to make sure that, you know, we're in agreement as to how those things are going to work out. But I think we're handling it well and continuing to see progress in all the other work packages. So I'm available for any questions if you have any.
None. What a huge administrative lift this has been. You must be happy to sort of begin to see the end.
I am very thankful that we have a couple more years. This is our 5th year of Senate Bill 1049. Yeah. So it is a big project. A lot of people go into this. I am just the tip of the iceberg, really. So yes.
Thank you for all your efforts.
Thank you.
Next is the 2022 earnings crediting and reserving.
Good morning, Chair Shinoy, members of the board. For the record, Matt Graves, Finance Reporting Manager. Today I present to you the final earnings crediting for calendar year 2022. If you recall, at our previous board meeting, we presented preliminary earnings crediting. Since that time, we've completed year-end accounting entries, what's led to a few very small changes and the final rates to the final rates from what you saw in February, amounting to a couple of basis points. And with that in mind, I would like to direct your attention to page 137 of your board packet, which would be page 4 of the final earnings crediting memo, which presents a table that summarizes the rates and reserves after crediting for each account. The table also shows the effect of investment expenses and administrative expenses on crediting. And with that in mind, at this time, are there any questions before we request a motion to adopt the final earnings crediting as presented?
I think we talked about it last time, so no questions this time.
Thank you, Chair Shinoy.
They're looking for a motion.
This is Board Member Jaramillo. I move to approve the final earnings crediting as presented.
Lawrence Fernstall seconds.
Thank you. All those in favor, please say aye. Sadhna Shinoy, aye.
Lawrence Fernstall, aye.
Stephen Buckley, aye.
Jordan Jaramillo, aye.
John Scanlon, aye.
So moved. Thank you. Last but not least, we have the discussion for the upcoming experience study. Milliman team, welcome.
Yes. Good morning, current and outgoing members of the board. My name is Matt Larrabee. I'm with the Portland office of Milliman. I'm here with Scott Prepernot. So we have, by our standards, a relatively short presentation today to talk about preparations for the upcoming every other year experience study cycle. Importantly, there are not any action items for the board today. So this is just information and discussion, if you will. So kind of turning to the first slide of our presentation, this is really kind of laying out the schedule for this biennium's review. We're going to talk about a couple of areas of emphasis today, a little bit of the overview. In a couple of months' time, we're going to have two board meetings inside of 3 days, that very important joint board meeting with the Oregon Investment Council so that we can all kind of get on the same hymn sheet relative to understandings on investments and contribution rates and how they interact with each other. We'll take a deeper dive at the June 2 PERS board meeting on economic assumptions and the system's funding methods. This is 2 years ago where we went really heavy on the rate collaring issue. We made those modifications. And then during May and June and July, our team will be doing a lot of demographic data analysis work on all of the active and retired member census data for Oregon PERS members. And then we'll come back and make any recommendations for changes or updates to demographic assumptions, and July 28th will be the final decision meeting where we'll set that assumed rate, which is so important, along with all the other demographic assumptions and methods. And these will set the contribution rates for the two-year biennium that begins July 1, 2025. Kind of skip over this slide and this slide. We put these in the record so that if somebody's new to PERS or gets interested, they can kind of see how the mappings work. We'll turn here to kind of our areas of emphasis today. We'll really have two. I'll cover the first one, and then Scott will cover the second. I'm going to talk a fair bit about the always prominent long-term investment return assumption, and then kind of a new and novel one this year, this biennium's version of the rate collar, will be a discussion of kind of how we have historically, through process, calculated rate contribution rate adjustments for site accounts, which a lot of employers have, and adjustments related to pooling arrangements, many of them in the SLGRP, which is the state and local government rate pool, if you will. Okay, so on to topic one, the assumed return. So we are trying to be good and local. Oftentimes when I went through my clip art phase, I have a Leatherman tool on here. We use the assumed rate for a lot of things. This year's rate will be selected at the end of July meeting. We use it as the discount rate for all of our calculations. So that affects contribution rates. It affects funded status. It affects the UAL, the unfunded actuarial liability.
Also, at an individual member level, we use that to calculate our AES, or actuarial equivalence factor, so that if a member has an account balance that's being converted to a monthly annuity, or a monthly annuity that's not in the normal form, converted to a different form of benefit to provide, for example, spousal survivor protection, that, again, that discount rate becomes critical in all of that. And for our remaining Tier 1 active members, it's also the rates that's used for crediting to their Tier 1 active member account balances. So our favorite simple equation, B equals C plus E, benefits equals contributions plus earnings. We refer to this as the fundamental cost equation, or the PERS funding equation. We, as the actuaries, our most important thing probably is to get that B, capital B, the benefits, accurate. Package of benefits is laid out by the Oregon legislature. Fortunately, B is predictable with a high degree of certainty, particularly for our current retirees, but even for our current actives as well. You know, we have a, you know, not for any individual, we have a pretty good idea over time, you know, if a group of 100 people, how many of them will still be in covered employment 5 years, 10 years, 15 years from now, how many will be retired. So we have a good handle on that. E is the unpredictable part. It's the actual for future investment returns on PERS assets. And so where C comes into play is that C is that balancing item. It's going to have to cover whatever the earnings don't do to get us all the benefits promised to the current and future retirees. And really, the board's charge is to set E as an assumption in a prudent manner so that we can get that right balance over time that's intergenerationally equitable between current taxpayers, future taxpayers, and getting C plus E right. Of course, whatever the board decides doesn't actually affect the earnings. As always, if it did, different recommendation. So this is a slide, you know, we do biannual reviews. This is kind of my span of time slide. We've got three different outlook models that we've looked at in recent years. Biannual reviews, which is why you've got odd numbers down at the bottom for every other year. It's 2023, new ones coming up. That blue line is the most important one. That's the OIC's outside investment consultant. So kind of in medical terms, that's your primary opinion right there. The actuaries, we also have our own model. That's the green line. And then we've been using a yellow line, which is a survey of about 20 or so investment consultancies as well. The yellow line has become more problematic in the last two reviews because it's a little bit out of date, which is why it appears to be moving in a counter-cyclical manner from the blue and the green. Board decisions are shown by those black X's. And I think this is a very, you know, this chart to me is a very nice complement to the board and their governance process, is that we have rarely moved away at all from that blue line, that primary opinion, but also the board, you know, we want to be responsive, but not overly reactive. And 2021 was a great example of that. The models went down a ton from 19 to 21. Did we move the assumption down? Yes, we did. We moved it down by 30 basis points. What's going to happen with this cycle? Those models are going to come back up. And so it will have validated the board's judgment in 2021 to be responsive, but not be overly responsive to large movements in the model. So in terms of the way that the decisions were made last time, this is all the data that we used from the prior meeting. Three outlook models, the one that's most important on the left, probably the OICs. The return assumption OIC, or the outlook OIC, had was 6.6%. That is two building block components. 2.1% was OIC's outlook for inflation. They tend to take a little bit of a narrower term view of inflation. And then real return, which is return in excess of inflation, the green, that was 4.5% for the OIC. Milliman, we had a different outlook on inflation. We're looking a little bit longer term. Our outlook was 2.4. We were a little bit more conservative at that time on real return. But in essence, the final board decision was a 6.9% real return, which you could view as 4.5 for the green. That's the OIC's number, their best estimate for real return, and the 2.4 from Milliman for inflation. So that's kind of where we landed last time, eminently reasonable.
6.9% total return. Not 6.9 real return.
Oh, sorry. Yep. Thank you, Scott. Yep. And so, you know, we will see the OIC's consulting outlook at that May 31 joint board meeting, but we've got our own model. We update it every 6 months, so we have our outlook available now. This chart shows what that looks like. 2021, the Milliman model, the return, the total return was around 6.3%. Depending on which time horizon we look at, our model is now showing expected return of 7.1 to almost 7.5%. A little bit more conservative for the first 10 years, a little bit more aggressive when we get to a 20-year time horizon. Why did our model move up so much? Well, you know, as you'd expect from a firm that has a lot of actuaries, we have a very quantitatively driven model. What's happened in the last 2 years? Price to earnings ratios have gone down on equities. Bond yields have gone up significantly. Rex Kim talked about that earlier today. You know, there's a lot of data that would say if price to earnings ratios are lower, you can increase your future expectations for equities. If bond yields are higher, you're increasing your future looking outlook for fixed income. Our models reflect that. We would anticipate that we'll see not necessarily the same magnitude, but certainly the same directional movement from Makita, who's the primary investment consultant to OIC, when we come back to the board with them in joint session in May. So, you know, it would be nice if it, you know, at some level as an actuary, it'd be great if we're operating in a bubble and we don't have to think about what anybody else does, but that's not kind of how the real world works. So, you know, there's something we said, okay, you know, outlooks are moving up. What are other systems doing? Well, this is showing what the median assumption is per NASR, the National Association of State Retirement Administrators, where Kevin's an active participant. They do a very scrupulous job of keeping track of the 130 largest state systems in the country. You can see that over the past 14 years, the median assumption has moved down to 7%. So we're still a little bit conservative to the median right now. Notably, even with these upward movements in the outlooks, we've yet to see a state system that has had an upward movement in their return assumption in response to these changes in the model. And the NASR survey covers about 130 state systems, as I noted. So we turn to kind of my final slide. You know, what are the considerations? Well, we know that the outlooks will be higher when we come back to you in the meetings at late May and early June. We're going to have that kind of time lag issue with the third input, which is the Horizon study. The Horizon study was published last August, and that's really, we were part of it. So we know what it was collected was a year ago, April. There's a lot that's happened in the markets and outlooks since then. So even if we have median forward-looking expectations from our model, from Makita's model, that are above our current 6.9% return, the board should consider leaving the assumption unchanged. Reasons for that. It took us a decade to get the assumption to where it is right now. And each one of those moves, in some sense, was a painful one from a budgetary perspective. It remains to be seen if kind of the conditions for our outlook, which were based on the end of last year, if those are temporary or if they'll be enduring. For example, if 2023 returns ended up being strong, by the time we get to the rate setting valuation date, which is at the end of this year, outlooks may have changed again, even though the board's decision's already been made. And then from an actuarial perspective, actuarial standards of practice are not symmetrical. So when we were in front of the board 2 years ago and that blue line and the green line were well below the board's 7.2% assumption at that time, we requested of the board, we said, you need to move, for under standards of practice, you need to move the assumption downward. We're too aggressive relative to what the models would say. Standards of practice do not require you to move the assumption up if the models are above your current assumption. A measure for conservatism is acceptable under actuarial standards of practice. So I think that's kind of my pause point for the setup on investment returns. So I don't know if the board members have any questions or comments before we move along.
I have a question, even though you didn't hold it, on the inflation assumptions.
Yes.
And I know Mr. Kim gave the market, you know, forward look at around that 2.5% and all. How do you think about the current data when you think about both the inflation assumption and the real salary increase assumption? Because certainly, I'm not seeing any numbers currently that are that low. But you know, if you look at the long history of the market, you might see something else. So,
I'll take a first hit at this, board member, first all, and then I'm guessing Scott will probably want to weigh in with his perspective as well. So, kind of consistently over time, when it comes to the inflation assumption, you know, I mentioned on returns that OIC's consultant is the primary opinion. For me, on inflation, the primary opinion has always been the intermediate outlook for Social Security's trustees. And that outlook report is issued every year. They're able to take a very long view. And there's some logic to that, given that we have, you know, projected 70 future years of payouts from our current members. Despite all the tumult in the markets and the kind of the high bout of inflation and everything like that, Social Security trustees, which issue their report every July, have not yet moved off of an intermediate inflation assumption of 2.4%. So we take all those data points into consideration, but it's not one where, at least where things stand right now, that I feel like a move is urgent on that assumption. You may have some other perspective, Scott, you care to add?
Yeah, I was just going to mention that where we note, for example, the Milliman preliminary model and the inflation assumption there. So the 2.4 and the 2.35 don't look very different to the 10 and the 20 year. Mm-hmm. But under the hood there, our colleagues who prepare the outlooks there are using input from Federal Reserve kind of near and long term expectations, blue chip forecasters, stuff like that. And if you were to see kind of the year by year, that does build in a higher earlier inflation for the first few years that trends down to something more like a long term. So the 2.4 and 2.35 are pretty similar because they're both longish terms, but it's not that our model has been blind to the fact that it has been inflation and likely will be higher inflation in the near term. It's just that consistent with the data that they're based off of, they're assuming it's going to come down to something longer term.
Do you expect any changes in the real wage assumption?
I think that's one we'll have to look at a little more closely when we get to the next stage of the experience study, including looking at the demographic information. And because there's a couple things here, right? There's the inflation, there's the kind of the general real wage, and then there's individual increases that can ride on top of that. And the data is really important for the individual increases, but we will want to look at what we've had in the recent years and also what we may anticipate given that there's been this inflation that maybe hasn't come through that yet.
Yeah.
So I don't know if we'll come back with something that is, you know, we can conceptually do something that's a different short-term versus a longer-term assumption if we feel like that's necessary, or sometimes we've kind of, you know, only partially adjusted to data or gotten directionally the way that we think the data is likely to trend based on, you know, bigger influence factors that are coming down the pike still.
Yeah, John Scanlon. I get the B equals C plus E. That's the kind of math I can do. anything past that is more complicated. But if we're in a negative cash flow position, then actually B doesn't really equal C plus E, right?
So, Board Member Scanlon, B equals C plus E over the long term, right? So, you know, the objective, it's really the fundamental cost equation, the personal money equation speaks to the span of time rather than to an individual year. And the fact of the matter is, and certainly Treasury is sensitive to this, they kind of keep a steady hand on the till and they're alert to it, is that the plan is in what I'd call a negative non-investment cash flow situation right now. Outward benefit payments are greater than incoming contributions. That said, that is actually a feature rather than a bug. Right. That's an indication that we've soundly attempted through the board's guidance to pre-fund the program during the employees' working careers. So in a myopic sense, in a given year, contributions are going to be less than benefit payments going forward. But that's a good thing, because I would say that if you looked around the country, the systems where that negative cash flow isn't happening at this point would be systems like Illinois, New Jersey, Kentucky, where they failed to be able to build up that war chest of E investment earnings. And so the fundamental cost equation is what it is. If E is not coming through for you because you haven't pre-funded the program, you're going to have to step up your contribution levels.
Yeah. Thank you. I think so far we've liked what you've said, so no questions.
All right, we'll see if I can change that. All right, we're going to spend a couple slides here on highlighting an aspect of the amortization methodology that usually is kind of functioning under the surface, and you see it in individual employer reports, but oftentimes it's not in the system-wide results, or we don't hit it too hard. But it is one that, in one way or another, we'll be bringing before you, or Jake and PERS staff will be bringing before you in coming meetings, because we do have side accounts and two different types of sort of flavors of adjustments to the rates that are tied to the SLGRP pooling, so transition liabilities or surpluses, or what are kind of called these more grouped pre-SLGRP liabilities and surpluses that affect individual employers' rates. If they've made a side account deposit, then it's a rate offset for them. Or if they are a member of the SLGRP, they may still have this amount that is part of their rate because of the their status relative to the pool when they joined it, essentially. And the majority of these amounts are amortized through the end of 2027. So it's still a few years away, but given the 18-month delay, given the way the rates work, and given, you know, wanting to build expectations for employers, we want to pin down some of the mechanics of kind of how an orderly expiration of these rate adjustments should look when we get to there. The graph in the bottom right just shows side accounts by amortization end year. So you can see by far the largest number are scheduled to run through 2027. Since this is really the big bulk of side accounts that came in when this kind of program first started in the early 2000s. And now there's still a decent amount that are quite a ways further out, some of the more recent side accounts, but we're going to hit a big chunk here that it's going to kind of the rubber hit the road. And for transition liabilities and surpluses, it's even more skewed. Over 300 employers are going to have their rate adjustment take effect around 2027. And there's only a few kind of who's joined in the last decade or two to the pool that have it marked further out. So as an example, show the rates for the state agencies from the most recent rate setting valuation report. And so what's called out here in the orange box is their pre-SLGRP pooled liability rate, which adds 1.3% about to the final rate, and a side account rate offset of 6.59% that subtracts from the final rate. So just with the state as an example, I mean, this is where there's going to be a need to figure out how exactly, how and when those rate offsets turn off. We know PERS staff has been working and talking to employers and getting input for kind of guardrails of what kind of procedure is going to work best for employers and work best for the system. It could be that some or all of this comes through in experience study, kind of methodology stuff that we bring to the board. It could come through as rulemaking. The answer may be different for side accounts versus transition liabilities because they are a little different in nature. But as an example on 16, I'm going to delve just a moment into the state agency side account. So that 6.59% that was shown on the prior slide is really developed here in the table in the bottom left. So that comes through in our valuation. We look at the outstanding balance, which was nearly $1.4 billion. Look at the payroll for that entity, and then an amortization factor that takes it to the end of 2027 and, you know, do the calculation. And that's where we came up with the 6.59% offset, which is essentially using this balance as prepaid contributions. How much can you, you know, spend down and lower the contributions in each pay period, in each month? And use that up through the end of 2027. So the graph in the bottom right, the blue line there, kind of shows that theoretical construct that if everything happened instantaneously and the rates and the offsets and everything goes to assumption, then that $1.4 billion balance gets spent down right to the end of December 2027. In reality, actual asset and payroll experience will mean that it doesn't look like that. Since side accounts do get their own asset return experience, and then obviously how much payroll goes different from assumption is going to affect how much you're drawing down on that prepaid contribution balance. So the couple dotted lines there illustrate just some really simple. The green line is what if we now fold in a 2022 loss, so the 1-2% that the system kind of experienced. And obviously that means that the balance draws down a little bit faster and you run out of the side account balance before the end of 2027. if payroll also grows above assumption, which is the dotted orange line, then it's even a little faster. So there's going to be a little bit of variation here on when things actually expire. And it could go the other way if investments were to have it, you know, go gangbuster, or for an employer whose their payroll is less than expected. So, but due to those fluctuations, really unlikely that any side account balance, for example, is going to hit zero right at the end of 2027. Could occur earlier or later. PERS, we understand, has an ability to track this month by month. But it's, again, worth sort of getting out in front of this and communicating the procedure, because some employers, number one, if the state agency's rate goes up 6.6% from month to month, you want them to know that well in advance, right? You want to smooth out this process and make sure that everyone's aware of what's going on. Some employers have funded originally these side accounts with pension obligation bonds and have a repayment schedule, so that repayment schedule may be going away at the same time the benefit from this is. So it may be, you know, budget-wise better than just having, you know, 6 or 7% increase in their PERS contribution rate, but the timing is important for them to understand. Transition liabilities, surpluses, and pre-SLGRP amounts, they fluctuate with payroll. They don't get the volatility of actual investment returns because they are more of the pooling notional way this was done. And they're only tracked annually. So the answer could be different for what is the right way to kind of retire these amounts than side accounts. But again, that's what we're just sort of previewing here today, and we'll come back with actual approaches to discuss. But again, since usually rate adjustments happen in a pretty orderly process, July 1, 18 months after a rate setting, something happening off cycle is unusual for employers, and we want to make sure it's well thought out and well communicated. Any questions on that piece? Otherwise, this gives a quick refresh on the experience study, next couple meetings, and then I have one brief item after this just for awareness. Last item has to do with an update to what are called actuarial standards of practice, promulgated by the Actuarial Standard Board. So this is an entity that produces and updates guidance for Matt and I, and not only pension actuaries. So the actuaries who, you know, set your car insurance rates, they get guidance from this group too. But one of our major standards, or one of our major ASOPs, was updated recently. Largely responding to requests for additional information from public plans. So it is going to be effective for not the valuation we're working on right now for IMPERS, that we will be working on this year, but next year's valuation due to the effective dates. But any parts of this can be reflected earlier if desired. The major and kind of the most prominent noteworthy change is a new disclosure item that is elegantly called the LDROM, Low Default Risk Obligation Measure, which is just saying that when we do a funding valuation and we calculate your results at, you know, here's how this looks at the board's adopted 6.9% assumption or whatever it is, then we're also going to put, for kind of sensitivity purposes, a number that says, what if we calculate that at a lower discount rate? The board was careful to say, you know, they're not trying to suggest this is the right liability. They don't expect anyone is using that should be using this for funding. But it's to give more information about funded status and volatility and benefit security. So that's the intent. It's a disclosure item. As I said, the main difference is going to be a much lower discount rate, because it should be derived from low default fixed income securities. So treasuries, high quality corporate bonds. It's also going to be a really volatile measure, because if we, you know, do this measure right now versus a year or two ago, we could be talking about, you know, maybe this rate is 5%. A couple years ago, maybe it would have been 3%, 2.5%. So it's going to bounce around a lot, and that's just its nature. You can compare the funding liabilities to this LDROM and get a view of it as, well, that's the expected but not guaranteed benefit of having a longer-term diversified portfolio. It's going to make expected to have a lower cost to fund the benefits over time, again, because that B equals C plus E equation. Or, you know, what would the cost be to try to shift to a low-risk portfolio, which is hypothetical because we project out benefit payments for 80, 90 years, and you can't buy good bonds to to cover those payments for 80, 90 years. But so that's where this is coming from. It's going to get a lot of attention. It has gotten a lot of attention in the press. You may have seen at times. NASRA, NCPIR, some organizations have put together FAQs for stakeholders to try to understand what this is and isn't. Because, I mean, people are concerned about, you know, people misunderstanding or misusing this relative to pension plan funded status and policies.
So who did you – I'm sorry. Who did you say asked for this?
There was a spirited conversation about pension funding back and forth, and this was one thing that got added to the, well, you know what, we can have additional disclosure items. Many pension plans in like the corporate space and Taft-Hartley space, union plan space, already have to produce something that meets this. So this, it is a broader requirement, but it's most relevant for public plans because there was no previously required numbers on this basis where, you know, a union multi-employer plan has both a long-term number and some short-term numbers that meet this requirement that are already needed from them under ERISA. So public plans are not under ERISA, and nothing was previously requiring this kind of disclosure. So that's where it came
from. I think it came from a couple places. There was external pressure from, you know, the academic community, you know, kind of critics of public pensions, you know, stuff like that. There was also some internal pressure in the actuarial profession as well from actuaries other than public sector pension actuaries. And I am eminently sympathetic to this because if the public pension actuaries, if a board, say the board, rather than having followed that blue line, the Oregon PERS board, like, you know, we've got a strong feeling 8.5%, we're gonna, you know, Rex Kim is going to come through for us. Under standards as they stand right now, the actuaries, you know, have a responsibility to maybe say, 8.5 really doesn't work for us, but they also may feel like their ability to continue as the actuary is at risk if they say that, or even if they say, well, what if you only earn 7.5% rather than 8.5%? So this is from the profession itself. It's also a bit of a spine stiffener and a requirement, if you will, that actuaries that feel like they're in that spot, they have to provide the sensitivity measure. It's no longer up for discussion, if you will.
This is Stephen Buckley. I have two questions. The first question, do you have a recommendation at this point whether to have an early adoption date or the adoption date for the 2023 valuation? Then the second question, is that adoption date an actuary's decision or a board's decision?
Good question. So I'll let Matt weigh in as well. But, I mean, I don't I guess I personally don't have a strong recommendation. We're happy to produce in this year's valuation an LD-ROM and include it with our, we already have disclosures that cover risk and variability in our report, and we're happy to add this to it sooner rather than later. We have done something like this. It was a number of years ago now, but I can remember preparing a table that was for a discussion with the board, which is here's the long-term assumption. What if the plan is set at earned, you know, 6 or 5 or 4? I can't remember exactly.
Three and a half. We showed what the cost of the plan would be. We earn 3.5% every year.
So we've done something similar to this when it's kind of been warranted for the discussion that was being had, and we're, you know, happy to do it as part of this year's valuation if it'd be helpful to get it in there earlier rather than later.
Yeah, and my response to that is that it, you know, same thing, not a strong opinion one way or the other. So if you don't have a strong opinion, you certainly can seek out the input of the board, and whatever the board wanted to do, we would do. Although that would be a 1-year decision.
Yeah.
Since next year it would be a mandate.
So would you think that this would be an agenda item as we move forward through the assumptions process?
I think, you know, it's a little weird because in the biennial review cycle, we talk about assumptions and methods. We're all thinking about rates and funded status and unfunded liabilities. And this affects none of that. It's an informational item, but it is high profile enough that it's probably worth talking to the board for the composition of this year's report, whether we kind of, if you will, for lack of a more elegant way to put it, early adopt this requirement rather than waiting until next year. If the board has a preference, I feel pretty comfortable saying that we just roll with that.
Okay. If I follow the Government Accounting Standards Board, which is almost as exciting as the actual Standards Board, I'm sure.
Yeah.
So for public accounting, unlike FASB, sort of private accounting, is you alluded to. In our financial statements of OHSU or another public entity that follows GASB, we give, for example, the unfunded liability and then a plus or minus one percentage point. You know, it would be higher or lower if instead of 6.9, it were 7.9 or 5.9. And then what the user of that, which is usually the rating agencies in our case, does is they say, well, if you were FASB and where you really want to do it at, you know, 3.9% or whatever they think a risk, less risk would be, they multiply by 3 times that, assuming it's linear. Do you have a sense about whether it's linear or not?
a delightfully technical question, Board Member Fernstahl. So it is reasonably linear. There is some convexity to it,
yeah.
But it's not wicked convexity. The further that you get away from the current assumption, the more the linearity breaks down. I know when we've looked at certain things on certain items, it's like, okay, I've got rules of thumb. If I have a 6.9% assumption, I have rules of thumb. I could come on top of my head and say, well, this is what it would be if it was 7.9, and this is what it would be if 5.9 or anywhere in between. That kind of, those rules of thumb in that space-time continuum, they start to break down a little bit when you get down and extrapolate the 3% range. I mean, they become kind of like cousins rather than like identical twins at that point.
Shouldn't ask which is higher.
Which one's higher?
Yeah. In other words, if you did a linear to 3 versus you actually presented what you will present at 3, which would have a bigger liability?
Which would have a bigger liability? Oh, gosh. Not sure. If I could, off the top of my head, you got me nervous.
Yeah.
I said the continuum breaks down. I mean, I'm going to defer, and then I won't ever have to answer that question.
Yes, I'll have the number.
I'll know by next time.
Best of luck to the board.
No, I off the top of my head, because it's been a while since I've looked at. We did this years ago for PERS with 3.5 while you were on the board. Yeah. I can't remember which direction that it goes in, and part of that may be down to aging process. And part of that may be down to kind of the whole theme with this ASOP 4 stuff, which is, okay, so, you know, it's kind of like almost like put as actuarial performance art, you know. So if we decided to invest per strictly in high-quality treasuries and high-quality corporates and treasuries, it's like, what would the cost be? It's like, okay, well, this is a theoretical thing. And that kind of strongly theoretical nature of it meant they probably wasn't as attuned on – it would be a natural question to say, okay, so it's not linear, which side? I don't remember.
It's definitely age.
All right. Just one last slide, really. And just to mention, so the LDROM is the most prominent thing out of this update, but there are a few other things, mainly going to be disclosure items that affect report wording. We discussed one of these relative to the should consider contribution lag in the actuarial audit discussion in recent meetings, which, again, we already kind of had language in there and considered that. So some of these we were already doing, but now it's a requirement rather than just something we were adding into the report. And then a couple others are kind of, you know, idiosyncratic things that they now want in the report. So we'll make sure we add exactly that. So that'll be employers and users may see some changes in the report, but that's about the level of interest for those. Okay. And that's what we have.
Removed a disclosure requirement?
Ooh.
I would draw.
Easier to add. Easier to add than delete.
Yeah.
Okay,
so that's what we've got. So appreciate everybody's time and questions today.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. So that brings us to the end of our agenda. We do have one other item. One of our board members has completed his term on the board and is leaving the board, and that's our Vice Chair, Lawrence Fernstahl. Mixed feelings as we say goodbye. I think Lawrence is the only one who's going to experience the good part of the mixed feelings. he has served on this board since 2015 and has waited very patiently and very graciously for over 6 months to be allowed to depart. So I'm sure you're feeling good about that. The loss is for the rest of us. Lawrence has a spectacular resume. He has served as the CFO of major universities and major medical schools for over 30 years. We have been very fortunate that you have given the time and taken the effort to serve on this board for so long. We will miss your keen perspectives, your analysis of data, and of course, your sense of humor. But most of all, what I will miss is the uniqueness you bring to actuarial discussions. You see secrets and significances in these slides that for the rest of us takes a while to be there. That's personally what I will miss, and I'm sure our actuarial team is definitely going to miss that aspect as well. So we wish you all the best as you move forward, and we hope you have something fun planned with your free time, because you are managing to escape these storms of information. Yes. And packets of the board packets that we all have to sit through. So thank you. And all the best.
If I could just say, first of all, thank you for your gracious words. I'd like to really express my appreciation for all the board members present and all the ones I've served with. It's been a great honor to serve with you, and certainly to serve with Chair Shenoy. All of our outside advisors, especially Milliman, who've been very patient. And particularly, I'd just like to note the incredible dedication of the entire PERS staff. I've been impressed from the beginning, and every meeting I'm more impressed by the dedication of the mission of PERS, of paying the right benefits that people rely on accurately and promptly, and keeping the system going. And that's been just very impressive. So it's been an honor to be part of that process.
I think Kevin might have something for you.
No. Typically, we have a present that shows the different blue books at the time that the board member has been on here. We have to review it a couple times because of the delay in getting it. It's grown significantly over the time. We've been waiting for a replacement. We do have one that will be going through Senate appointment shortly, so we're pleased with that, but we will be missing you.
Okay. Well, thank you very much.
Your car will be big enough.
It will be. There's a lot of blue books in there. All right. Thank you very much.
Thank you so much.
Okay. Okay. Anything else from the board? Jardon, shall we begin the audit meeting at 11? 10, 15
that works.
Minutes?
Yeah, 11 o'clock.
Jason, is that okay?
Wonderful.
Okay, so thank you everyone for participating. Our next meeting is the joint meeting with the OIC on May 31st. This meeting is adjourned.
Oh, well.